This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, October 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, coming to you today from Dallas, Texas, and the studios of KERA Public Radio. I'll be here through Thursday, bringing you our regular show, along with stories from Dallas and from the Texans who live here. You know, the World Series is a big story in Houston, not far from here. The Astros are in. We're going to talk about that later this hour. But southeast of here, nearly 2 months ago, Hurricane Harvey made landfall and devastated the Houston area. Since then, workers have cleared mountains of debris from homes and from city streets, and more than 120,000 people have visited disaster recovery centers run by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. But the rebuilding effort here is still part of daily life for hundreds of thousands of more Texans, particularly along the Gulf Coast. They say FEMA isn't meeting all their needs, and there are reports of denied assistance and slow response times. Judge Stephen Brent Carlton is the top elected official in Orange County, Texas. That's a mostly rural county along the coast east of Houston. Judge Carlton called on FEMA to help after Harvey, and he's here to tell us how that help has been going. Judge Carlton, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First, Judge, give me a sense of how bad the damage was in Orange County around your way.
Orange County suffered significant damage due to Hurricane Harvey. About 60% of our homes were affected. That's about 26,000 homes out of 40,000. And a significant number of our businesses were damaged. And so far, we've picked up close to a 250,000 cubic yards of debris.
A 250,000 cubic yards of debris sounds like an enormous amount. How much more cleanup is there to go?
That gets us about 60% through the first pass. There's going to be three passes to pick up debris.
And so you called on FEMA, Judge, for some disaster response centers. What'd you ask them for?
Well, initially we asked them for two disaster recovery centers, just due to the number of our citizens that were affected. Ultimately, they said they would give us two mobile disaster recovery centers. Those are kind of ones that they set up in parking lots with RVs. Well, we let our citizens know where those services were going to be, on what date and what time. One of them showed up, the other did not.
So they promised two and you got one. What happened when you called them back?
Well, we definitely gave them a call back quickly. We had elderly couples waiting out in the parking lot in the heat, trying to get to that disaster recovery center that did not arrive for them. FEMA did set up the tents, oddly enough, but no services were there. So we did call them and let them know that this was an unacceptable situation for our citizens.
What did they say?
They told us that they were stretched to the max as far as resources, and that's why the second one had not arrived. They did say that they were going to start rotating the one mobile one between the two spots. It's been a few days in one place and a few days in the next place. We told them that was not enough and that they needed to get us more. Ultimately, after several weeks, they did get us two disaster recovery centers.
Judge, what are the services here at these disaster recovery centers? What are your citizens getting there?
The main thing that people get is they can talk to a FEMA representative face-to-face. Most of our citizens have experienced extremely long wait times whenever they call into FEMA. Some of them as many as 4 hours that they're waiting on hold. So this gives them a chance to talk to people face-to-face, ask a lot of questions, and get the assistance they need. The disaster recovery centers also offer the SBA, those are the loan programs through the federal government. They can get those services there as well.
And how many folks in your county are looking for these services?
There were 28,000 of our citizens that registered with FEMA. So far, 14,000 have been approved. Another 10,000 or so are pending. FEMA has done well for some of our citizens. They've received about $82 million in federal grants. And through the SBA loan program, about $79 million has been approved.
So some of the aid and some of the money is coming through. When people went to visit these centers that you tried to get, and there was one, not two, and then some rotating around from parking lots, what did this mean for your people who were trying to get their lives back in order?
Well, they obviously have gone through a very devastating time for themselves personally. So they're already kind of on edge and don't have a whole lot of patience. And so when they show up to a parking lot and the services aren't there, they get really frustrated. They're obviously upset with FEMA, and they're upset with the local government for telling them that FEMA was going to be there. And so, they don't like the idea of having to drive another 20 miles to get to the recovery center that is open.
Yeah, they're upset with the federal government, and also they call you.
Yes, they call me. They call our commissioners. They call their mayors. Understandably, they want answers. They want the help that they believe that they should get. So we do our best to try to guide them and get that help for them.
And so now, Judge, that it's a couple of months out, I know you've had this difficulty. What's the situation now in Orange County? Are people able to access this aid quickly and more efficiently than they were before?
Yes, they are now. As FEMA resources have kind of moved east after they've kind of worked on areas in Rockport and others throughout Texas, as they kind of move more resources this way, people do get better access to it. There are two full-time disaster recovery centers open in the county, so that has helped a lot for our citizens.
So, Judge, President Trump has given his administration very high marks for the storm response, not only in your neighborhood in Texas, but in Florida and Puerto Rico, saying that FEMA's done a great job. Everything has gone pretty much according to plan. According to your experience and the experience of people in Orange County, you would say what?
I don't know necessarily I would give it an A+. I do understand the fact that their resources are stretched so thin, covering Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and now the California wildfires. But one thing I would have liked to have seen a little better is some of the coordination and communication. So if they tell us that we're going to get two of these disaster recovery centers, either deliver two or let us know that they're only going to get one before people start showing up and waiting in a parking lot. A+ would be, I think, perfection. I think that's kind of unrealistic for anybody to have in a situation like this.
And if you asked one of your Orange County folks down at the grocery store in the parking lot what marks they might give, what do you think you'd hear?
Well, for the ones that have received aid so far, they may give it a B+ or an A-. For the ones that are still waiting, I'm sure they would be willing to give it an F.
Recovery in Orange County in Texas, as some people get their FEMA aid and many people still waiting for it. Judge Stephen Brent Carlton, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And you've been telling us about your experiences getting relief or assistance from FEMA. We got this from Perth Amboy in New Jersey. We got a grant of $30,000 to raise our house on a New Jersey barrier island. A great deal of paperwork, but ultimately worthwhile. And from New York City, the FEMA funds took a long time to process, and the amount wasn't enough to cover the damages from Hurricane Sandy. Have you had experiences with FEMA? Let us know. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. So FEMA is trying to offer help on the ground in places like Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico. But the money comes from Congress. The Senate is set to vote as early as today on an aid package worth $36.5 billion for hurricane relief. Congress is facing pressure to act quickly here, but not everybody is happy about what they're getting. Sungmin Kim is a congressional reporter for Politico. Sungmin, welcome back.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you. $36.5 billion. How big is this new aid package given the size of the destruction that we've seen across Texas and Florida, Puerto Rico, and wildfires out west?
I mean, it's certainly not big enough, the home state senators say, to deal with the aftermath of these major hurricanes in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico. We actually had some objections from powerful Republicans late last week, including Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn of Texas, the number two Senate Republican, because the aid package wasn't big enough. And there was actually a small risk that Congress wouldn't be able to send this package to President Trump this week because some of the Republicans were demanding that the package go bigger. But late last week, Senator Cornyn got some concessions or extractions from the administration, saying there's going to be another bucket of funding money coming soon from the administration, maybe perhaps sometime in mid-November, that should take care of further needs in those states. But it is enough to cover the immediate needs right now. But certainly, if you talk to senators who are helping their constituents deal with the aftermath, it's certainly not big enough.
So $36.5 billion, I mean, we heard quotes after Harvey that people in Houston thought the cleanup might be $150 billion. It makes sense why senators are running back to the White House and saying this isn't going to be enough. But aside from just cash, Sungmin, what's in this bill?
So there is, in terms of cash, we have an immediate money infusion of cash into FEMA, which is running out of money very quickly. We also have, there's about almost $19 billion in that bucket. We also have about $16 billion to shore up the National Flood Insurance Program, which has had some financial problems that have been well documented. But this is so people, particularly in Texas, who had the first storm can get their claims paid out. It also includes includes a nearly $5 billion loan to Puerto Rico that actually is meant to help Puerto Rico pay out some liabilities they have in terms of, you know, payroll for their government employees and funding some pensions. And it also includes a provision that allows low-income residents in Puerto Rico to basically get food stamps, food assistance, the same kind of food assistance that people in Texas and Florida currently have.
What about the Jones Act, Seungmin? We reported a few weeks ago that people in Puerto Rico, members of Congress, were clamoring to get this part of the law that requires U.S. flagged ships and U.S. crews to deliver materiel to Puerto Rico. The Trump administration suspended it for just 10 days, but now it's back on. Is that part of the fight here?
It is part of the it's not part of the final package, but it's definitely part of the fight. I reported yesterday that there were at least two senators, Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona and Mike Lee of Utah, who weren't going to let the package pass as quickly as it could because they wanted to make a point about permanently exempting Puerto Rico from the Jones Act. Now there is legislation to do just that, authored by Senator Lee and also Senator McCain of Arizona. They said this clearly hampers aid issues. They believe it's an antiquated law. It doubles the shipping costs from between various U.S. ports. When if you ship the same goods from a foreign nation, it's actually half that cost. So they say there's a lot of reasons to permanently exempt Puerto Rico from this law that was enacted in 1920, but it's not part of these final negotiations. But clearly, this is going to be an issue that continues to come up in these funding negotiations.
Yeah, they'll have to fight that out elsewhere. Seungmin, you know, there's been a lot of dissatisfaction, a great deal of reporting from Puerto Rico. Numbers like 75% of the island in some places still without power. People in the middle of the island who still don't have regular access to food and water. Are lawmakers talking about this? Are senators using this bill to demand answers about the response in Puerto Rico?
You have a lot of vocal Democrats saying that attention to Puerto Rico, especially on Capitol Hill, is starting to diminish a little bit. I mean, there have been particularly lawmakers from Florida and New York, where there are large Puerto Rican populations, are being vocal. Senator Chuck Schumer suggested over the weekend that maybe there should be a permanent kind of relief czar, someone to oversee this effort. But for now, it does get overshadowed by a lot that's going on Capitol Hill. You have fights over tax reform. You have fights over foreign policy. And we'll mm-hmm. continue to have these aid discussions. But again, yes, it is falling from the radar a bit.
Seungmin Kim of Politico, thanks so much. $36.5 billion looks like it's headed to the White House for disaster relief. Welcome back, and thanks for joining us today. It's Todd Zwillick coming to you from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. And here in Dallas, they're trying something different when it comes to addressing homelessness for their students. About 3,600 students are homeless, according to data from the Dallas Independent School District, and 90% are economically disadvantaged. Texas has the third highest number of homeless students in the entire country. And that's why over the last 5 years, Dallas Independent Schools have opened 20 drop-in centers right in their high schools. These drop-in centers provide students with breakfast, juice, snacks, along with other essential items that they just might not have, things like socks, like toothpaste and deodorant. And they're geared towards young people like Brittany.
Like this one time, my mom had kicked me out, so I came to the drop-in center. And I didn't have no food, and she helped me out. She gave me food. She encouraged me to keep coming back to school because I really was going to drop out.
Bill Zeeble is here with me now in the studios. He's a reporter with KERA News here in Dallas. Bill, thanks for being here.
Hello. Thanks to be here.
Bill, first of all, that number I just cited, 90% of students in the Dallas Independent Schools are economically disadvantaged. That's an astounding number.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. The Dallas Mayor's Task Force, crunched those numbers, and it turns out that Dallas is one of the biggest districts in the entire country with low-income students.
That may be, Bill, but how can it be that 9 out of 10 students there are economically disadvantaged? Is there a demographic divide here where wealthier students just all live in the suburbs?
That's part of it. There has been, we've done stories of white flight over decades For example, the student population in Dallas going back 50 years might have been 155,000. Today, it's 155,000. The population of Texas and of Dallas has ballooned over decades. But those with money and those wanting a quality education, they say, we can't get it at this school district. We're going to the suburbs. So that's where you have the population change. Those who live within Dallas, many of them, low-income, minority.
So 9 out of 10 students in that district with economic disadvantage, an astounding number, as we said. The district is trying to respond with these drop-in centers. How do they work?
Well, the drop-in center, obviously the name is, let's keep them from dropping out. Let's make school a safe place. If you're hungry, if you're homeless, home may not be a place where you feel happy and healthy. But school, you're there, a huge amount of time of your day, and they want you to learn. Texas wants you to learn. Dallas wants you to succeed. Let's make this school not just a good place to learn, but a safe place. You can't learn if you're hungry. You can't learn and succeed if you're homeless. So the drop-in center says, we have not only food for you and clothing items, toiletries here for you if you need them. We have counselors. We have ears for you who will listen to you. And so some of these kids, they live with their families, but maybe a home is, renting by the month because there's no permanent address. Homeless, the definition is there's no permanent address. Maybe they're living with a family or mom with several siblings, but they've been kicked out of their house or they're low income or they're immigrants finding some place to live. They're living with relatives. Maybe the kid is sofa surfing. That's the definition of homeless. And so the drop-in center really says, here, you can settle in here for a while. And it's open an hour before school starts.
So, Bill, you're describing the scope of the problem across Dallas schools. You spoke to Mark Pierce, who's the general manager, right, of the drop-in centers across Dallas.
Yeah, Mark Pierce had been the guy who said, let's create drop-in centers. He'd been the homeless operations director for Dallas ISD, but then kept saying, we have so many kids with so many problems. They aren't just at the poorest districts in our city. They're across the district, all over the place. So he said, maybe we need more.
No matter which high school you go to, you're going to find disenfranchised teens for one reason or another. Either not living at home because they can't get along with their family, or they're staying with friends, or they may have lost their family, or you may even have students whose entire family is on the verge of homelessness, and we can help with those situations as well. So I believe in a drop-in center in every high school in the country.
He believes in having it in every high school in this country. Is this a model that Dallas is going to export?
Well, it may be. Whether it gets exported, it's up to other cities, other states. But Mark Pierce says that San Antonio and some other cities, big cities in Texas, have visited here and they're trying the very same thing, putting these centers in the high school. Every district in the country has to take care and deal with its homeless students, but frequently they are at nonprofit centers dotted around the city, not in the schools.
Bill, you've been talking to the students. We heard from Brittany at the top. You talked to another student, a 17-year-old guy, Cameron Williams.
Yeah, Cameron, he's not only 17, but he's his own guardian because he just didn't get along with his mom and he was up against it. He lived at home, then she kicked him out, then he lived with another guardian, and it was like hell.
My mom got to the point where she pretty much said that she didn't want me no more. She refused to, like, help me out with school and stuff like that. So I got to the point where I had to, like, ask for help. And I asked, like, what can I do? And they said, like, she agrees to it, then I can make myself my own guardian.
Bill, Cameron is a young man clearly in need who got some advice at the drop-in center. Is this system well-funded? Can it expand in Dallas? Where's it going?
According to Mark Pierce, the funding is within the district. In the drop-in centers, the expense is just opening an hour early, and many of these folks, they're already in the school. So it's like find a room, and then you get some nonprofits to help stock it with some kind of like a small food pantry, clothes and stuff like that. There are donations. And so I think it's well-funded, Mark Pierce says it's well-funded, and so they just have to find a room across in high schools, and they can.
And when will they be able to show results? Obviously, food, socks, toothpaste, important on their own. What about the number of kids they keep in school, the number of kids they keep from dropping out, things like that?
I looked for those numbers, and Mark Pierce says they're still crunching those numbers, but points to several hundred kids who graduated, and so that's a success. But it's hard to know, would they have dropped out? It's hard to know. You hear Brittany McCowan say, oh, I would have dropped out if not for the drop-in center. It's hard to track those numbers because if the kid suddenly gets a home, they stop showing up at the drop-in center. I mean, they're in and they're out. It's kind of a transient population. It's hard to track anyway. It's hard to track, actually, how many students a district has who are homeless because who wants to admit it?
Bill Zeebel with KERA News here in Dallas. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Let's go to Russia now, where last week one young man stepped forward and filed the first formal complaint against an anti-gay purge in Chechnya. Maxim Lapunov told a group of human rights activists in Moscow that he was held against his will and brutally beaten for 12 days by Chechen authorities. Reports first came out 6 months ago that gay men in Chechnya are being detained and beaten by authorities there. Then over the weekend, the story of Chechen pop singer Zelmykhan Bakayev surfaced in the media. Bakayev has been missing since early August and may also be the victim of an anti-gay purge. Human rights groups report that Bakayev is believed to be in detention, but details surrounding his condition are unclear. Rachel Denber is deputy director of the Europe and Central Asia Division at Human Rights Watch, which has been investigating reports of abuse and abduction in Chechnya.
This spring, we documented a pattern of Chechen security officials abducting, torturing men presumed to be gay in order to get them to name other people who were gay. That mass campaign came to a close sometime in the early spring when there was a federal investigation that was launched. But abductions have continued, certainly not on the same scale, but they have continued. Now, what's changed is that, as you mentioned, Maxim Lapunov has stepped forward. He is the only person to step forward as a complainant. And he was able to do that because he is not Chechen. Lapunov is ethnic Russian, and he had been in Chechnya on a work trip, and he was rounded up when he was there. So he doesn't have all of that baggage. Chechnya is a very conservative society, and people who come out and say, I was abducted because I was gay, really put themselves at risk of an honor crime by their own families. And they also, you know, they don't want to stigmatize their families because being gay is not at all accepted in Chechnya. Meanwhile, what's happened is that, as you mentioned, Zelimkhan Bakayev, a pop singer who was popular in Chechnya and then moved to Moscow and has been living there for several years, went to Chechnya in August. And as you mentioned, on August 8th, he completely disappeared. His family was very worried about him. His mother reached out to Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov for help in finding him. Now, Bakayev is known to be gay. That's not known, or that was not known in Chechen society. And that is a huge stigma. Now that he's been missing for so long, people have made public that he was part of the gay community in Moscow. And some of his friends have said that they have spoken to people who saw him being taken, basically, at a shopping mall on August 8th.
And Rachel, we should be clear, the source of these detentions or potential tortures or harassment, it's the government in Chechnya, right? Not some vigilante group.
No, there's no doubt about it. This campaign has been approved of at very high levels in the Chechen government. People who we interviewed for our report in May told us that at least two fairly high-level local officials, security officials, were actually at these sort of basements where they had been held and witnessed, you know, the beatings and saw the men being held there. There's no doubt about it.
These two men that we're talking about, Zelmykhan Bakayev is famous in Chechnya. People are interested in him because he's a pop star. Maxim Lapunov came forward. But how many gay people in total in Chechnya do we think we're talking about who've been the victim of these pogroms?
You know, Todd, it's hard to say. The Russian LGBT network, which organized the evacuation and assistance for the victims of these purges, they've been helping a total of 27 people who were direct victims of the purges. They have learned about another 15 people who, after they were released from their ordeal. They were released to their families and no one's heard from them again. So that's a total of at least 42 people. But those are the only numbers that we know about.
Rachel, you mentioned that the government in Chechnya and society is extremely conservative. Is there a religious aspect to this animosity in Chechnya?
The Chechen leadership says that they're protecting Chechen traditional values. They don't say that it's Islamic traditional values. They say that we're protecting our Chechen culture.
Rachel Denber of Human Rights Watch, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Game one of the World Series between the LA Dodgers and the Houston Astros kicks off tonight in Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium in Chavez Ravine. The game's expected to be one of the hottest on record, and I mean the temperature, inching nearly to 100 degrees, it's predicted. It's also the first time that two 100-win teams have faced off in the World Series since 1970. Joe Sheehan is publisher of the Joe Sheehan Newsletter, contributor at Sports Illustrated. Hi, Joe.
Todd, how are you? Exciting day here, getting ready for the World Series.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I'd be more excited if the Nationals were in, but hey, we never make it out of the first round. Joe, aside from trying to keep cool, what are you watching for tonight?
Yeah, I think the heat's going to play a factor here. The Dodgers have been one of the most patient teams in baseball at the plate. They led the league in walks. They led the league in walk rate. So I think they're going to want to wait out Dallas Keuchel, the Astros starter tonight. You know, let him pitch long innings in that 97-degree heat. I think the heat's going to be a factor. Usually we talk about the cold and the rain in October, but this year it's about 100-degree weather.
Let's talk about Clayton Kershaw, the dominant pitcher for the Dodgers, Cy Young winner, phenomenal curveball, but a perception that he doesn't perform well in the playoffs.
Right. He's the best pitcher alive, but his postseason track record isn't that great. There's some factors in there. One just being you face better competition in the postseason and things happen. If you look at his track record, he's had games where he'll go six shutout innings and then have a big blow up inning. He had a number of those against the Cardinals in the postseason. What we've seen this year, Todd, is that the Dodgers haven't put as much on him. They've used him aggressively, not giving him sufficient rest in other postseasons. And this year, he's been able to take his regular turn in the rotation, and he'll be taking his regular turn tonight. He's pitched better this postseason than he has in recent postseasons. And one of the stories I'm looking forward to is him getting that monkey off his back, him showing people that this is just, you know, a story as opposed to actually a weakness in his game.
You know, on the Astros, we could talk about Justin Verlander, the ace pitcher. He's got his fastball back. He's pitching better than he has in a while. But let's talk about Jose Altuve, the star hitter, star player for the Astros.
Yeah, Jose Altuve, really one of the most fun players in the game. He's 5'6". Well, he's listed at 5'6". Yeah, I'm listed at 180, too, so we can debate that. He doesn't have a little man's game. He hits for power. He drives the ball. This is somebody who's been with the Astros back when they were losing 100 games a season. So really one of the great stories is that this player who was, you know, taken, signed by them, you know, 10, 12 years ago, was with them when they were terrible, is now getting to be a part of this. And he's not just, not a little man playing a little man's game. He actually had so much power and so much speed this year that he's likely to be the American League Most Valuable Player.
Well, Joe, the Dodgers haven't been in the World Series since 1988, but, you know, one of the big storylines here, the Houston Astros in the World Series. I mean, Houston could really use a win, the city, couldn't they, after the devastation of Hurricane Harvey?
No question. A.J. Hinch, their manager, talked about that yesterday at the press conference and, you know, trying to bring the city, back together. It wasn't a divisive event, but it was certainly a difficult event. And when you can be a part of that as a sports team, we talk a lot about sports being the toy department of the world and, you know, how much does it really mean? But we've seen sports serve as a galvanizer, you know, in New Orleans after Katrina, in Boston after the Boston Marathon killings. And I think this is another occasion where baseball can step in, American sports can step in and help bring a city, give a city a moment that it really needs.
Houston could really use the lift, Joe. On the other hand, you know, the Dodgers had such a phenomenal year during the regular season that everybody said if they don't win the World Series, it's all wasted. They have to win a World Series or this incredible year they've had goes to waste.
See, I don't really buy into that, largely because baseball doesn't work that way. When you look at, particularly in the last 25 years with this playoff format, we've seen good teams get knocked out at every level. The Mariners won 116 games and didn't even make the World Series. I think baseball's about the journey. You want to win the championship at the end, but when you have two great teams, and you mentioned at the start, two 100-win teams for the first time in almost 50 years, either one of these teams winning is the story. The one that loses has still had a fantastic year.
162 games in a season. The World Series starts tonight in Los Angeles in Chavez Ravine. Joe Sheehan, publisher of the Joe Sheehan Newsletter, contributor at Sports Illustrated. Joe, enjoy the game.
Thanks, Todd.
You know, cyber attacks make big news when they hit government and big corporations. Hackers hit Equifax, they hit Yahoo, they hit Sony. The U.S. Office of Personnel Management lost control over the private information of millions of Americans after a data breach. Here in Dallas last April, the emergency management system was hacked, and it woke up Dallas residents with a jolt. All of the city's 156 tornado warning sirens began going off in the middle of the night. A lot of lost sleep and a lot of 911 calls here in Dallas. But hackers don't always go for the rich and powerful or just for nuisance. Increasingly, they're going for schools and for kids.
A number of families around our district had received physical security threats sent to their cell phones. Very pointed threats using the child's name and the school they went to, and then some sort of threatening message about harming the child and or the school.
That's Laura Sprague. She's a spokesperson for the Johnston Community School District in Iowa. That's one of dozens of school systems targeted by cyber thieves in recent months. Schools in Massachusetts, New York, California, Texas, Georgia have also been targeted. Sprague told us that in her Iowa district, it was a two-pronged attack.
After that, the hacking group said that they had hacked one of our third-party vendors and received student data files as a result of that hack. So it was not only physical security, but informational security. That was the type of thing that we had not encountered before. This was new territory for us.
So the key question here, are school districts prepared for attacks like this? Can students and their parents be prepared? Doug Levin is president of EdTech Strategies. They're a research and consulting firm doing business with schools. Doug, why are hackers zeroing in on schools and on students now?
Unfortunately, the answer is that they are soft targets. Their technology systems are not always up to date, and they don't necessarily have the expertise to be able to manage these new digital threats.
So what exactly are hackers doing? What are they after?
So they're after a few things. Largely, they are after money. And so they'll use a variety of tools like ransomware or phishing attacks, that's phishing with a PH, to fool people, to give them credentials. And that results then in identity theft, where they're stealing people's income or even filing fake tax returns on their behalf. They also are looking to disrupt schools. And unfortunately, we're seeing a new wave of attacks, like we've heard from in Johnston, where they're threatening physical violence to children.
So, Doug, if the schools themselves are soft targets, what about the students? What makes them so attractive? Do they have the money to pay ransom?
No, they don't. And so it's very interesting. So when people think about cyber attacks on schools, they immediately think about the adults, the teachers. They have incomes, they have mortgages, they have car payments, they have credit cards. The thing that makes students and minors attractive is that they do not have a credit history. And so if a thief can steal the identity information of a minor, they can open a credit record, start to open accounts, and use those for many, many years until that child turns 18 and tries to open an account themselves and find themselves denied because they have a long history of bad credit that has been established by criminals.
A blank slate of cybercrime, as it were.
Absolutely.
Well, it seems like maybe a lot of schools sort of cruised along for years here, Doug, thinking that they couldn't be targets. We're not Sony. We're not a big corporation. Who would want to mess with us?
I think that's right. But I think in the, you know, in the grand scheme, it's only in recent years that K-12 schools have really started to rely on digital tools. They've always been available in the classroom. They've always been available in the school district. But now it's hard to find a classroom that doesn't rely on the internet to do some part of teaching and learning. Their textbooks are online. That's how they do research. Their telephones are connected to the internet, their HVAC systems, their security systems, even school buses. And so this is a relatively new thing in the history of schools. But it's also the case in schools that as much money as it costs to deploy all these tools, we've probably been underinvesting in IT support and management. So there are far fewer staff in schools supporting this technology use than you would see in a typical business. And as a result, you know, mistakes get made.
You know, Doug, these attacks have been going on. We mentioned they've been happening all across the country, Massachusetts, New York, Iowa, California. Why don't we hear more about this? They seem to fly under the radar.
They do. It's really interesting. And so I've noticed the same thing. And so one of the roles that my firm has played has been trying to just capture and catalog the variety and frequency of these incidents because that information is not well reported. One of the reasons for that, I think, is that there is no mandatory, in many cases, no mandatory requirements for people to disclose when they've had an attack or when they've had a data breach. And as you can imagine, people in schools, like in other organizations, don't sort of race to put out press releases to talk about how they have been compromised. But as taxpayers and as parents, this is information that we really need to know.
Doug, is there a state that's getting this right? Is there one state in the union that has recognized this problem and is doing more to protect their school districts?
I wish I could answer with a very strong and affirmative yes. What I would say is the work in Missouri by the state auditor actually has been quite helpful. The state auditor there has been conducting cybersecurity audits of school districts and helping them to get a handle on all of the data that they collect and how they secure it. It is a voluntary effort, but it's very promising in the direction that it's heading, and many other states would benefit from a similar approach.
So what can students and their parents do, Doug? I know that a school district can call you for your services, but an individual family isn't going to do that. What can they do to protect themselves?
Well, I think the most important thing would be to raise it with their school leadership, their principals, their superintendent, and the school board, to make sure that they're aware that there are policies and procedures in place to prevent these incidents from happening. But on a personal level, I think there's a number of things that people can do to help secure their own information much more strongly than probably many of us are already doing that. The first is using strong passwords that are unique, so you're not reusing your password from service to service. Secondly, if you have a smartphone, you can set up what is called second factor authentication, but basically a second step when you log in that will protect you in case your account does get compromised. The third thing that you can do is run antivirus or anti-malware software on your computer. And then the fourth thing would be just to make sure that your computer software is up to date. Install those patches, install those updates. That will help protect you and keep you secure.
It's not just Yahoo, it's not just Equifax, it's also your local public school that might be vulnerable to cyber attack. Doug Levin from EdTech Strategies, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, America has watched police shooting after police shooting. The circumstances, sometimes justifiable, often questionable, and sometimes outrageous. Through it all, though, a storyline has emerged.
There is a war being waged on our police officers.
There's an oppressive force in the way that criminal justice engages with black bodies.
And it becomes unrepairable. It doesn't take a lot for things to spiral out of control.
Put their minds somewhat at ease when they're out here on the streets and not be so aggressive, because they're supposed to protect and serve, not kill us all.
They want to invite for coffee and dinner people who tweet out support of convicted cop killers.
Most of you guys don't know what it's like to be followed in the store for no reason, to be stopped and pulled over for no reason.
It's simply not going to end.
Today we launch a new series here on The Takeaway. It's called To Serve and Protect: Life Behind the Blue Line. We're talking to police from all across the country for this series. We're asking them to share their experiences being law enforcement officers in these highly politicized and emotionally charged times. How do police officers feel about their sometimes conflicted role in society? And what do cops want us to understand that doesn't get told in the media? Really, what's it like to be a cop? Well, today we start with one of Dallas's own.
My name's Aaron Tobkin. I've been with the Dallas Police Department for going on 9 years now. My rank is what we call senior corporal. I'm a field trainer, so I'm responsible for training rookies who come out of the academy. But I went in at 39 years old, which is definitely pretty old for starting a police career. You know, I was in the academy with a lot of younger guys, you know, a lot of people who were just out of college or maybe just out of the military. This was their first real job. It was a little bit tough. It was hard keeping up with some of those young guys, but I think that I also brought some stuff to the table, maybe just a career, a lifetime of talking to people, dealing with people, being in the customer service business, which ultimately is kind of what police work is. being an officer is all about communication, regardless of whether you're talking to, you know, somebody who's called 911 who needs help, or whether you're talking to a suspect or you're talking to other officers. And that's how we avoid problems out in the field. That's how we avoid having to use force or having to take things to the next level as best we can. And I think that that builds a lot of bridges, and that makes people feel a lot more positive about the police in general. Maybe one of the negative parts of where policing has gone is that we don't get that opportunity to make personal relationships with people out in the street as much. And it's not that officers don't want to do that. It's that we spend, the vast majority of our shift just responding to those 911 calls. And unfortunately, that doesn't really leave a lot of time for the individual police officers to do what we call like self-initiated policing, to do things that are not just answering calls, because we have limited time, limited resources. But I think in Dallas in particular, that relationship is pretty strong with what happened last July.
We interrupt this evening with breaking news out of downtown Dallas.
All right, look, we're looking back in Dallas, Texas. This is disturbing.
The planned protest there has erupted into gunfire.
I'm not sure what we're seeing, but it looks from this vantage point like an officer down.
Oh my God.
Chaos erupting on the streets of Dallas at 9 p.m.
Somebody's really armed to the teeth.
In the aftermath, 5 Dallas police officers are dead.
The outpouring of, I don't know what else to say other than just love from the community. I mean, people came into stations. I think it was a solid 3-4 weeks that every day we just had people voicing their support and putting up signs and tying blue ribbons around trees. And it made you know that the relationship is not as bad as maybe some people might think it is, just if all they're really exposing themselves to are the stories that tend to portray things maybe in a negative light.
Police pulling up to 12-year-old Tamir Rice. Take a look at this in Cleveland.
For the second time in 2 days.
Two videos in 2 days.
I know that, you know, the media, their responsibility is to report what happens. I think the frustration that sometimes police officers feel is that you'll have a giant pool of positive interactions between police and between the citizenry. You know, with the numbers I've seen put it in the tens of millions every single year. And most of those contacts end either without incident or with a positive outcome. I can tell you that most of the calls I answer when I leave, most of the citizens are pleased with the service that they got. You have officers out there doing like straight up heroic things all the time. Every single day, I see it all the time. And then they feel like what gets reported is just these handful of negative interactions or controversial interactions that happen. And so I think that's the frustration. And it can push officers to feel like that maybe somewhere behind there's a narrative that somebody wants to tell that's contrary to what's actually happening out there. Do tensions exist between the community or certain communities and law enforcement? Without a doubt. That tension is brought on by a long history of, you know, bad relationships between law enforcement and certain communities in the United States. And it was probably the function that law enforcement fulfilled at different times, which is a very oppressive, very, you know, racist function. As obvious as it is that tension is there for a reason, it's also just as obvious that things have changed dramatically, that departments have changed the way they do business, that they've changed the way that they hire officers. And so to fix it, I think that departments have gone a long way to doing that with new training programs that teach officers a lot of less than lethal tactics with tasers and sponge rounds and things like that, you know, that reduce the number of fatalities that officers will have with interactions with citizens. I think that helps a lot. But I think that long term, the only thing that's really going to help, and I would love to see this, is that we need to educate. I think that officers, we need to be in the schools. They need to be out there from the time when kids are very young and get a history of positive interactions between the kids and between police officers. If there was something that I would want to leave the public with, it's that police officers vary a lot. We're a very diverse group of people. We're as diverse as the United States is diverse. And so I think there's a lot of times that people think that police are like this separate race of people, this blue race. And what one officer does is reflective of what every single other officer does. Nobody would want to be lumped into a group and be responsible for everything that the group they're a part of does. And so I would just encourage people out there to look at officers the same way that you say that you try to look at other individuals as just individual people. We're not all one blue race. We're all individuals.
That was Senior Corporal Aaron Topkin from the Dallas Police Department. Tomorrow, we'll hear from one of Corporal Topkin's recruits, Officer Justin Milton, also of the Dallas Police Department. And we want to hear from you, too. If you're a current or retired police officer or have family that work as cops, we want to hear your story. What do you want the public to know about your job and the day-to-day reality that you think the media is missing?
This is Sheree from Elmira, Oregon. I didn't personally have family members that were police officers, but we did have friends. And as a young girl, one of my best friend's father was a police officer. The one thing that I noticed was the loneliness. He was always gone, always on shift, always on duty. I don't remember seeing him ever.
This is Sean from St. Paul, Minnesota. I do have a brother-in-law and several friends who are police officers. I'm a supporter of Black Lives Matter, and I support the NFL players' right to take a knee. But I also think that we need to give police officers a break to a certain extent because they're constantly dealing with people who lie to them all the time, and this makes them skeptic, almost to the point of paranoia. So it's a lot harder to get the message across to them in a way that they believe.
Your voices on the lives of police officers in America. What do you think the public needs to know about being a cop that might be misunderstood or might not get into the media? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, coming to you from KERA here in Dallas through Thursday. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.